This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Palgath. The stakes are high for the U.S. Senate race in the state of Georgia, and both President Donald Trump and President-elect Joe Biden know it. President Trump is wrapping up a rally in the southern state, urging Republicans in a conservative area to turn out to vote in Tuesday's special election. The election will determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate. The president said himself, the stakes in this election could not be higher. He also repeated the false claim that he won the presidential race in Georgia. Election officials from both political parties have stated publicly that the election went well, and international observers confirmed there were no serious irregularities. President-elect Biden spoke at a drive-in rally in the state earlier on Monday, saying Georgia can chart the course, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next generation. Biden noted that Georgians had voted in record numbers in November, notching him a narrow win in the state. He added, "And now we need you to vote again in record numbers." On Monday, the president-elect also denounced President Trump, saying he spends more time whining and complaining than he does working on solving the pandemic. The Senate campaign stops come after Georgia's top election official, Brad Raffensperger, said on Monday that President Trump had pushed him to take what he called an inappropriate call. On the call, which was recorded and published by U.S. media, the president is heard asking the Secretary of State to find more votes and overturn his November presidential election defeat in the state. Two Democratic members of Congress asked FBI Director Christopher Wray on Monday to investigate the call. More on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. A national lockdown for England as the region continues to fight the surge in COVID-19 cases. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson made the announcement Monday evening in a televised address.
You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law, such as to shop for essentials, to work if you absolutely cannot work from home, to exercise, to seek medical assistance, such as getting a COVID test, or to escape domestic abuse.
The current surge is gaining speed due to a more contagious variant of the virus, and the Prime Minister said urgent action must be taken to slow the spread and relieve pressure hospitals are under. The lockdown is expected to last until mid-February. Saudi Arabia will lift a years-long embargo on Qatar. That's according to Kuwaiti Foreign Minister announced the deal on Kuwaiti TV on Monday. The agreement reached to open airspace and land and sea borders between Saudi Arabia and Qatar will be signed at the Gulf Cooperation Council Summit in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday. Saudi King Salman will chair the gathering. Qatar's leader is now expected to attend the meeting for the first time since borders were sealed more than 3 years ago. A British judge has ruled Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the United States because of the risk he will commit suicide. Assange is the founder of the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. The district judge delivered the verdict Monday. The judge saying procedures described by the U.S. that Assange would be kept in almost solitary confinement meant that the U.S. prison system could not prevent him from taking his own life. Assange faces 18 U.S. federal charges relating to allegations of hacking, theft of classified material, and the disclosure of the identities of U.S. informants. Prosecutors have appealed the verdict. The judge said she had reached the verdict after considering evidence from psychiatrists who said that Assange was planning to commit suicide if he were to be extradited. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador offered political asylum to Assange on Monday. It's a move that could anger the United States. López Obrador said he wanted his foreign minister to ask Britain if it could release Assange so Mexico could offer him asylum. The Mexican government also said on Monday it would come up with a plan to deal with migrants stuck in the country as a result of outgoing President Trump's policies. He also stressed that Mexico is not to blame for the flows of people. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. France arrests a former DRC rebel leader for crimes against humanity.
Today, they say that Lumbala has been arrested, but we think that Lumbala is only the smallest fish of the cake.
UN Secretary General condemns weekend militants' attacks in Niger. Kenyan schools reopened yesterday, Monday, despite coronavirus concerns. Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission issues its report on security forces' killings of protesters. And Uganda's Bobi Wine threatens protest against any irregularities in the coming January 14 presidential election.
Ugandans are not going to allow a process that is going to disenfranchise them. They're not going to allow their votes to be rigged. They're not going to allow their voices to be curtailed. That's the message that we are sending to Mr. Museveni and those around him.
And Nigeria is grappling with the more virulent variant of the COVID-19 virus. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the weekend attacks by unidentified gunmen on two Nigerian villages. In a statement read by spokesperson Stephane Dujarric, the Secretary General expresses deepest condolences to the bereaved families and the people and government of Niger and wished a speedy recovery to the injured. He hopes that the Nigerian authorities will spare no effort in identifying and swiftly bringing the perpetrators to justice while enhancing the protection of civilians. Meanwhile, the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic, also known as MINUSCA, has condemned the attacks launched over the weekend by armed groups against the towns of Damara and Bangassou. Maka Ndiaye, the head of mission, said he had no doubt that the attack took place to disrupt the Central African Republic election. French authorities on Monday arrested Roger Lumbala, a former rebel leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for his alleged complicity in crimes against humanity. Lumbala, 62, led the RCDN party, an armed group that UN investigators said was responsible for extrajudicial killings, rapes, and cannibalism during DRC's civil war from 1998 to 2002. Emery Damien Kawira is president of the Congolese Coalition for Transition. He says his group is surprised by the arrest because Lumbala was merely a small fish in a tank of big fish human rights violators in DRC.
We are first surprised by this news. We heard it this evening from French justice from Paris. But we are surprised because since a long time, our coalition, Congolese Coalition for the Transition, and the Nobel Prize, Dr. Mukwege, we are asking the UN to open the mapping report, which reported all the crimes which had happened in DRC from 98 until 2003. And now today, they say that Lumbala has been arrested. But we think that Lumbala is only the smallest fish of the case. We are asking the International Justice for the Crimes in Congo could go ahead and to give the root responsible, the spirit responsible of this genocide in DRC. We mean here the international justice, French justice, must touch the big fishes. Big fishes are in Rwanda, are in Uganda. And until now, the soldiers from Rwanda and Uganda continue to kill in DRC.
So let's talk a little bit about the big fish that you're talking about. When you said the big fish, are you talking about Rwandan and Ugandan military people who were in DRC helping Lumbala?
Yeah, because it was not only Lumbala. It was Lumbala, it was Jean-Pierre Bemba, it was Moussa Nyamwisi, it was Azarias Ruberwa, and a lot of other responsible. Now, on behalf of the CCT, Congolese Coalition for the Transition, I ask to the UN to the French justice, to the U.S., to facilitate us to have that international justice court for the crimes which are being committed in Congo, in DRC.
What do you make of the charges, the allegations against Lumbala himself, that he committed extrajudicial killings, rapes, and cannibalism during the DRC civil war? What do you make of those charges against him?
That we say that Lumbala was only the tool. He was like the tool that they were using. But now we need to know who was using the tool which called Lumbala and who was using him. It was Uganda and Rwanda. Now we hope that Lumbala will tell to the France justice who was using him and when it will tell this rule. So we hope that all the big fishes, I repeat, will be captured. They will be captured by the international justice and they will have to respond about their crimes and genocide they are doing in DRC. But if they only stop their process on the person of Lumbala, it will not be good, no interesting.
Emery Damien Kawira is the president of the Congolese Coalition for Transition. You're speaking with us from Paris. Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Rabo Chakulai, popularly known as Bobi Wine, says he will protest any illegalities and irregularities in connection with the country's January 14th presidential election. Joel Senyanyi, spokesperson for Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party, says Ugandan security has repeatedly harassed Wine and his campaign. However, Ugandan police say they are simply enforcing COVID-19 regulations.
We have concerns about the process right from the time of consultations, our candidate was denied chance to go out and consult because the election starts there pretty much. Because an election is not an event, it's a process. And then the way the campaigns have been held, that our candidate cannot be allowed to go to certain areas, go to certain districts, he's been denied access to media houses and all these different places. And now, you know, a lot more that we hear that is being cooked by Mr. Museveni, his regime, in concert with a couple of people within the electoral body. So these are concerns that we have. These are concerns that we are raising, and we are telling them, look, we are very alert, you're every step, and so will not. Ugandans are not going to allow a process that is going to disenfranchise them. They're not going to allow their votes to be rigged. They're not going to allow their voices to be curtailed. That's the message that we are sending to Mr. Museveni and those around him.
Is the Honorable concerned that the elections could be rigged? I mean, what is the evidence?
Of course, he is concerned. The rest of us are concerned. But we know that ultimately the power of the people transcends everything else. You know, and that's why we say people power. So that's why we are rallying the people. Come out, vote in droves, take your vote. They will try to vote. I mean, they will try to rig. They will try to do many things. They will try all the machinations. But ultimately, the power of the people will prevail. That's our hope. That's our hinging point.
I was reading an article in the Monitor on Monday. The article says that more than half of the people that were shot to death during last November's protest were between the ages of 14 and 30, and that nearly a dozen of the 54 victims confirmed by the government were in the productive 30 to 50-year-old bracket. What is the reaction to that?
It's very unfortunate that Mr. Museveni has decided to kill those who oppose him, to kill those who don't support him, those who support Bobi Wine, you know, as opposed to doing the right thing, because the young people that are protesting peacefully, the rest of us that are opposing him, because we want a better country, we want better health care, we want better education, you know, we want jobs for our young people, many of whom are unemployed, we want a better economy, we want the human rights violations to stop. Those are he should be addressing, as opposed to shooting dead people that are opposing him, people that are against his policies, and all of that. You know, so those are the critical issues that he should be addressing.
Of course, President Museveni said that these young people were being urged on by the opposition, being responsible for the way the young people behaved.
These are not just young people. These are Ugandans, you know, with a sound mind. They know what they want. would have to tell them that now come out and oppose Mr. Museveni. They are opposing him because they don't have jobs. They are opposing him because they are being brutalized. They are opposing him because when they go to hospital, there's no doctor to attend to them. They are opposing him because when they take their children to schools, probably there's no structures. Children are studying under trees. So no one needs to tell them to rise up and oppose Mr. Museveni. The circumstances really lead them to do this.
You know, the president has said in the midst of the COVID-19 that the presidential candidates are not adhering to the Ministry of Health guidelines, which was responsible for some of the action of the police.
I think that's hypocritical. Look, I'll tell you that every candidate, right from the incumbent, Mr. Museveni, the candidate has had challenges, you know, in fulfilling the regulations to the letter. Mr. Museveni has had crowds, you know, in fact, they hire people, they give them T-shirts, they give them money, they come out in droves. He comes out of his car, waves at them, talks to them. You know, the only difference is that his supporters will not be beaten when he does that. But when Bobi Wine does that, his supporters get to be shot at. But also the irony that you are trying to protect people from dying from COVID-19 by shooting them dead, it's very illogical. It does not make any sense at all.
Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for Uganda opposition presidential candidate Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party. You are speaking with us from Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 5th. An official of Ethiopia's government-appointed Human Rights Commission has been given details about the commission's report last Friday that security forces killed at least 76 people and wounded about 200 during protests last June and July following the killing of popular musician Hakalu Hundessa. Mesgana Mulugeta is senior advisor to the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission.
Our investigation focused on 40 localities in Oromia region, selected based on preliminary assessment of where the violence occurred following the killing of artist Hakalu Hundessa. We have talked to victims, witnesses, and authorities in these areas and collected data from hospitals and other relevant authorities. The unrest lasted for about 3 days, from June 29th to July the 2nd. So totally 123 people were killed, 500 people were injured. The first major finding on this report is about the commission of crimes against humanity. We found that the overall conduct carried out by the attackers who were organized in groups is not a simple act of a crime. We did find out that it's a crimes against humanity, which is an atrocity crime and a grave violation of human rights, partly because it was a widespread and systemic attack against civilian population that extended to at least the 40 places that we visited. Many of the targets in the attacks were selected on the basis of ethnic and religious identity. So because of that, we believe that crimes against humanity were committed. The other major finding is about the conduct of security forces. In some of the localities, security forces had appropriate preparedness to stop, but we still believe that the lack of preparedness on the part of the regional government to prevent such attacks, including in those localities where similar attacks have taken place before, have exposed people to a repetitive cycle of violence and abuse.
You say in your report that Ethiopian security forces killed 76 people and wounded 200 during the protests last year. Did you share your report or your findings with the Ethiopian government? And what was its response?
Yes, we have shared our report with the federal government and the federal parliament and the Oromia regional government and the regional council and all relevant government institutions that we have forwarded recommendations. We also expect everyone will take public notice of the report. There has not been a formal reaction yet, but we definitely will have a discussion with them and will definitely follow up on the recommendations, the implementations of our recommendations. We believe that's why we're here, as a constitutionally mandated independent national human rights institution.
One of the key words I see throughout your report is that of attackers. Who were these attackers and were they ethnic based?
As indicated in the report, many of the attackers were groups of people who started coming out in the streets of many of these towns in Oromia region to express their griefs on the death of the artist, which later on degenerated into attacks and protests. In some areas, people traveled to nearby towns to join the attacks, but in some areas, victims and witnesses have identified them as residents of the areas. Majority of the victims, as again indicated in the report, were either ethnically or religiously targeted.
You said your commission has found that crimes against humanity were committed by individuals and groups. That's a serious charge. What is your recommendation?
Yes, it's a serious crime, an atrocity crime, and really worrying for the country and its people. That's why we've made a list of recommendations. First is around accountability, where we said those responsible for the commission must be brought to justice with due regard to their due process rights. There should not be impunity to atrocity crimes such as this one, and government needs to identify and hold accountable the perpetrators of the human rights violations that occurred during the widespread security crisis, and to regularly update the public on the process. Second is around recognizing the risk of atrocity crimes in this country. We have recommended for the government to come up with a comprehensive atrocity crime prevention strategy in line with the prevention tool recommended by the UN. We have also called for legal and institutional responses to protect minorities. The third is around victims' redress. We have made recommendation for appropriate compensation and rehabilitation of those who have suffered physical, mental, and material injury. We have also asked for the establishment of victims' fund that would allow for a harmonized and sufficient compensation for victims of human rights violation as per international human rights standards.
Meskena Mulugeta is senior advisor to the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. You are speaking with us from the capital, Addis Ababa. Schools in Kenya reopened Monday after being closed since March due to the coronavirus. But Kenya has yet to contain the pandemic, and there are concerns among teachers and parents about being exposed to the infection. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenya shut schools in mid-March as a measure to contain the virus, which has killed nearly 1,700 people in the country, according to the Johns Hopkins University's coronavirus dashboard. 47-year-old Ken Ouko is a father of four. Ouko says he worries that students will not follow safety protocols when they return to school and will bring the virus home.
There'll be some degree of protection, but the kids are still going to interact. What we've noticed in normal school days is that these kids don't even wash their hands, even when they've been told to wash their hands. But they're still going to touch each other. They'll be playing football together. They'll be riding bikes together. When they're in the buses, they're playing games. It's not very easy to control them, in my opinion.
Visiting one of the schools in Nairobi, Education Minister George Magoha said parents should try to remain positive as schools reopen so children can resume their lessons.
When you look at the spirit of the body and spirit of the teacher, the body and spirit of the children, do they require encouragement or discouragement? Let us encourage them. That's all I can say for now. We may not be perfect. There are very many children here. If water becomes a problem, we are on standby to ensure that they have water so that they are able to wash their hands when they come out.
Teachers say it will be difficult to maintain physical distance as most schools do not have enough classrooms to spread out the students. Umu Anzala is a virology and immunology professor at the University of Nairobi. He acknowledges that social distancing may be a tall order for a lot of schools, both public and private. He says schools can follow other health protocols to fight the spread of the coronavirus.
We want to really enforce that all the kids are taught how to wear masks and then sanitation. They have to be taught how to wear masks, and then they should wear masks consistent when they are in class, when they are in the playground, wherever they are going to be within the school. They should be able to have facilities where they can actually be able to sanitize.
In all, 16 million Kenyan school children returned to school on Monday. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigeria is grappling with the more virulent variant of the COVID-19 virus amid a second wave of the pandemic. Health officials say infections spiked after people ignored an advisory against intra and intercity travels. Dr. Anthony Ibe is assistant professor of medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He says Nigeria should expect more deaths and hospitalizations in the coming weeks.
For Nigeria, with our poor health system, overcrowding, and lack of social safety net by government or other local governments and so forth, it frightens anybody who looks at it. For example, if you read the recent report by the Lagos State Health Commissioner, Professor Bayomi, was talking about five hotspots in Lagos, and they're having some areas positivity rate as high as 31.3%. That is extremely high. So Nigeria, therefore, is at risk of an overwhelming spread of the disease and affecting and killing so many people.
The health authorities are blaming the citizens for not heeding a travel advisory when it was issued, and that is responsible for this widespread and also the variant.
There could be blames to go around for everybody. The citizens cannot be blamed for the variant. We haven't found out the reason why the variant has occurred. Even in the United Kingdom, you saw there was a variant. In South Africa, they have another one. So variants of this virus will occur, pop up in various parts of the world. That will be a given. In terms of adhering to preventative measures, the citizens may be blamed to some extent, but you also want to look at it against the background of what is happening. If you're poor, your whole livelihood is dependent on trading, there is no government subsidy or some kind of remedial check or something, what are you going to do? It's the problem. So that's where the government needs to come. You can't ask people to stay home if they don't have food to eat. They'll say they'd rather die. So that's where the government must come in and say, we will be able, if we're going to do a lockdown or have people to stay in, we'll be able to make sure everybody gets one bag of rice, one bag of garri, or any of this basic sustenance for the next 2 weeks also. And then everybody, minimum wage of, if you're maybe 2,000, 3,000 naira, I don't know what exact number it would be for each family, then people can take you seriously. People can now listen to what you're saying. Because one, it'll be for a short period of time, and two, it will help to, you know, cut down on the spread. And more so, we have not perhaps done a good job in the messaging.
Critics of the government are saying that the government failed to adequately message the population, especially in a country where you have close to about 100 different languages.
I agree with you that messaging is important, is very, very important, especially when there are all kinds of conspiracy theory. You even know in the United States, some people say it doesn't exist, it's a manufactured disease, and you go online, there are all kinds of weird theories. You can therefore imagine what the situation is in Nigeria. A number of people say it's a white man's disease, it's a Western disease, it doesn't happen here, the heat kills the virus. Wrong. So that's where you're correct that the messaging is important. The government needs to go down to the local level, different languages, local level, even in broken English that everybody would like to understand. Involve the market leaders, involve the towns and the local community leaders, involve the traditional leader, involve the youths. In fact, one of the slogans should be COVID-19 or Corona is everybody's disease.
Nigerians are known for their communal living. And a lot of people are saying that's also part of the problem. So how do you navigate this?
One, let us all believe and know that this will be a short-term thing. This is not going to be our life going forward. This will be a short period. So if we say, please do not visit your relative in the next 2 weeks, in the next 1 month, let them stay in their own households.
That was Dr. Anthony Ibe, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and Georgetown School of Medicine. He spoke with Chinedu Ofor in Washington, D.C. And that's it for this Tuesday, January 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndumbulo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.